our little study programs. When the holidays fall as they do this year, in truth, it's a truism to say that Rosh Hashanah never comes on time. It's either too early or too late, and maybe this is right. But I must say, from my perspective, the best time is when it leaves us a little bit of time to really prepare for it. And to do this kind of study is a tremendous blessing. The best way to do it, of course, is with Rabbi David Silber, who we welcome again, once again, this evening. Rabbi Silber, as the founder and director of Drisha, is one of our foremost teachers of Bible, of Torah, and it is a schut for Congregation Or HaZeruah to be able to welcome him once again to teach us and to help prepare us for the proper frame of mind and the knowledge to accept and welcome Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Rabbi Silber, Baruch Haba.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rabbi Wexler, and thank you for inviting me back. Very happy to be here and to study with you this evening. Last year, after I spoke, Rabbi Wexler invited me already back for this year, and he actually even suggested a topic, which is the story of Yishmael Hagar, which essentially is the Torah reading for Rosh Hashanah. The Talmud says that on Rosh Hashanah, the Talmud lists the different readings, and of course Rosh Hashanah in the Torah is one day. And it says that on Rosh Hashanah we are reading Vashem Pakad et Sarah, which is the 21st chapter of Genesis. Then when there's a second day of Rosh Hashanah, we are reading the binding of Isaac. So the real Torah reading for Rosh Hashanah, it's interesting, is the one we do the first day, which is begins with the words that God remembered or redeemed Sarah. And essentially the Torah reading has three parts. It's the first part deals with the birth of Isaac. The second part deals with the banishment, expulsion of Ishmael. And finally, the reading concludes with Abraham's treaty with King Avimelech, the king of the Plishtim. I thought we'd focus this evening on the Ishmael and Hagar story, but we'll probably have make reference also to certainly the beginning and perhaps even the end of the Torah reading of the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Before I begin, I wanted just to point out that the story of Abraham, or the Abraham narrative, as we have it in the Torah, essentially consists of a set of stories. And what's very interesting is they're essentially doubled stories. All the stories of the Abraham narrative, or almost all of them, appear twice. There are two lech lechas, two commands to get up and go, which is chapters 12 and 22, which is sort of a frame of the story. There are two stories involving Abraham's nephew Lot. There are two stories involving Avimelech. There are two stories where Abraham says that Sarah is his sister. And there are two stories which involve Ishmael and Hagar and Abraham and Sarah. So chapter 21, which tells us of the expulsion of Ishmael together with his mother Hagar, is the second of the two stories. And in order to understand chapter 21, we have to first turn our attention to chapter 16, which describes the birth of Ishmael and the story in which Hagar, for the first time, runs away after being oppressed or mistreated by Sarah. So let's briefly look at chapter 16, and we'll turn our attention to chapter 21. One of the questions I think we want to think about is specifically not so much about the text of the Torah, but additionally, why perhaps this was chosen as the Torah reading for Rosh Hashanah. The text obviously mentions nothing about Rosh Hashanah, and yet was chosen rabbinically, already in the Talmud, almost 2,000 years ago, as the recommended reading for Rosh Hashanah. Chapter 16, which in this translation of the Sansino is on page 56, begins by telling us that Sarai Eshet Avram, Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian slave, handmaid, Ushma Hagar, her name was Hagar. So, chapter 16, of course, follows upon chapter 15. Chapter 15 We're told of the covenant that God makes with Abraham, the so-called covenant of the pieces, in which Abraham is promised both a successor, Abraham being childless to this point, and also promised the covenant of the land. That's essentially the content of chapter 15. And now in chapter 16, we're told that his wife Sarai, as she's known then, is childless, as is Abraham, but she has a slave named Hagar. And Sarah suggests in the second verse, Vatomer Sarai Avram, she suggests to Avram, she says, look, she says, God has prevented me from giving birth. Go unto my slave, my female slave, my Shivcha, perhaps I will be built up through her. And the Torah says, Vayishma Avram l'kol Sarai, Abraham hearkened or obeyed or listened to Sarah. So the incentive to give Abraham the slave as wife comes from Sarah. Her reasoning is that, or her thinking is that, perhaps I shall be built up through her. It's kind of surrogate motherhood. Hagar, the slave, will give birth to the child. But Sarah will be truly the mother of the child. She'll be built up, perhaps even the play on the word Ibanen, the word Bain. I will be sunned through her, as it were. That was the idea. And the Torah then says that Sarah, in fact, Abraham's wife, the Torah adds in verse 3, took her slave, an Egyptian slave, Hagar, after 10 years of living with Avram in the land, and gave her to Avram, her husband, as a wife. Vayavo el Hagar vatar. He went in unto Hagar, and she conceived. Vatera ki harata, when she saw she had conceived, Vateka al gavirta b'yeneha, her mistress became light in her eyes. And in the next verse, which is a critical verse, the Torah tells us of Sarah's response to this situation. Vatoma Sarai el Avram, chamosi alecha. So Sarah said to Avram, chamosi alecha. The wrong, or my wrong, is on you. Anochi natati shivchati b'chekecha. I gave my slave into your bosom. Vatera ki harata, when she saw she had become pregnant, v'aykal b'yeneha, I became light in her eyes. Yishpot Hashem b'ni u'v'necha, may God judge between us. So I want to stop here for a moment and reflect on this verse. What's interesting about the verse is that it doesn't say that when Sarah was treated or thought of lightly by Hagar, that she was angry at Hagar. The text doesn't say that. She clearly is angry at Hagar. Later on we see this, but that's not what the Torah says. She went to her husband Abraham, and she said, "Chamosi alecha, the injustice is on you. I gave you this woman, and now she treats me lightly. May God judge between us." Yishpot Hashem, those are fighting words. May God judge between us. So it's an attack on Avram. And the question we have to begin with, because this will color our understanding of the whole story of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar and Ishmael, is what precisely is angering Sarah? What is Sarah's claim over here? How does the Torah present her claim? The first thing we note about the story, and remember, chapter 16 is following upon chapter 15. Chapter 15, we're told about a covenant and the terms of the covenant. The terms of the covenant in chapter 15 are three. Because in return for the ultimate possession of a land, after many years, 400 years, in return the Torah says for three things: being a stranger, being enslaved, and being tortured. In the words of the Torah of chapter 15, Ger Yezaracha, your descendants will be strangers, Vavodum, someone will enslave them, and Ve'inu Otam, somebody will oppress them. In return for those three things, that's the covenant, those are the terms of the covenant, you receive the land, you possess the land, which after all, in the context of Genesis, the sacred space was the purpose of the initial creation, the Garden of Eden. The sacred space is a replacement in the book of Genesis for Eden. Eden's the sacred space we can't possess. Canaan is the sacred space we potentially can possess. These are the terms of the covenant. The Torah does not specify which descendants will enter into the covenant, but those are the terms of the covenant. Now in chapter 16, right after the covenant has been set up, we're told Sarah can't have children, but she has a slave. Being a slave in the context of a covenant is a very good thing. It's one of the three terms, to be enslaved. And this slave has a name. Her name is Hagar, the stranger. Hey Gimel Reish, Hagar is a stranger. So she starts off immediately with two of the three requirements for the covenant. She's a stranger, and she's a slave. All she has to do is be tortured and she'll be fine. Which, of course, the reader understands will happen, of course, in the story, Vatanel Sarai. But the point I'm making, because that's a different session, but the point I'm making is that what the chapter is really about is who enters into the covenant. And that this child, the child that will be born, presumably enters into the covenant, and that his mother seems to be very well credentialed for this. She's a slave, and she's a stranger. She'll be tortured soon. But the point is that we have to bear this in mind. That's what's at stake over here. But the point is that the story of the birth of Yishmael revolves around Sarah and Avram. The initial plan is that the real parents will be Abraham and Sarah. And in the middle of all this is this woman that Sarah brings into the house as Abraham's companion. And we know something else about this woman. She's a Shifcha Mitzrit. She's not just a slave. She's an Egyptian slave. Now the question is, where would Abraham, who travels from the north, have picked up an Egyptian slave? But the Torah actually tells us where. Because the Torah says, back in chapter 12, in the very beginning of the story, that Abraham, shortly after he lands in the land of Canaan, traveling north to south, there's a famine in the land, in chapter 12, and Abraham went down to Egypt, it says, for the famine was heavy in the land, it's chapter 12. Before Abraham descends into Egypt, he turns to his wife Sarah, and he says to his wife, this is found on page 47, he says, behold, he says, in verse 11, before he gets to Egypt, I know now, he says, you are a beautiful woman. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is this man's wife. They will kill me and keep you alive. Please, he says, say you are my sister, in order that it go well for me on your account, and that I live because of you. And sure enough, what happens is when they came into Egypt, the Egyptians see that Sarah is beautiful, and they saw, the officers of Pharaoh saw her, praised her unto Pharaoh. She was taken into Pharaoh's house. And Abraham did well on account of her. He had oxen and he asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses and camels. Amongst the things given to Abraham, as Sarah is taken by Pharaoh, are female slaves and male slaves, avodim ushvachot. So it's logical to assume that Hagar, the Egyptian slave, is one of the shvachot given to Abraham in chapter 12. At the time when Sarah was taken. We have to remember that Sarah is taken by Pharaoh after they go to Egypt, but that Abraham is fully aware of the danger before he gets to Egypt. He makes a choice to go there on account of the famine. The choice involves imperiling his wife. And of course, as he says about himself, say you're my sister in order that it go well for me and that I live. It's not just about survival then. It's about doing well. And in fact, he does well. Uli Avram Hetiv Bavura. In order to understand this whole relationship of Abraham and Sarah, remember, the story of descending into Egypt is at the very beginning of Abraham's career. It's shortly after he goes down to the land of to Canaan, God's insistence. So I do want to spend a few minutes understand this idea of going to Egypt and what it entails in terms of their relationship, potentially entails, and I think does entail, in terms of their relationship. In order to understand this fully, we have to go back to the very story of Genesis and think about sort of the primal sin in the book of Genesis. The primal sin in the book of Genesis, the first sin, as the Torah describes it, revolves around forbidden fruit. Adam was commanded explicitly, though he may eat of the entire garden, but of the tree of good and evil he may not eat. Torah says that his companion, his wife, who was seduced, as it were, by this snake, he convinces her that it's all right to eat of the fruit. And the Torah says the following. It says, Vatera Aisha, the woman saw. The woman saw. Let's just find this verse. This verse is, let's see, where is this verse? Chapter 3, let's see. It should be chapter 3 of Genesis. The woman saw. Yeah, it's chapter 3, let's see, it's on page 11. The woman saw, Vatera Ha'isha, she saw Ki tova eitz, that the fruit was a delight to the eyes, and the fruit was good for food, a delight for the eyes, and it was desired to make one wise. Vatikach mi priyova tochal. She took of the fruit and ate. Vatiten gam liisha ima vayochal. She gave to her husband who was with her and he ate. This is the primal sin. So what does the primal sin consist of? Disregarding a command and taking what you see. The woman saw, that's how the Torah sets it up. She saw that it was good and she took. So it's seeing and taking, and seeing what? Seeing that it's good, kitov. Now this combination of verbs, seeing and taking, combined with tov, actually appears shortly thereafter in Genesis as well. A very difficult set of verses. That's in chapter 6. There the Torah says that in chapter 6, beginning of chapter 6, that after the human being began to multiply on the earth, in verse, page 18, so it says that, very strange verse, the Bnei Elohim, literally the sons of God, or the powerful ones, saw the daughters of the human, ki tovotena, that they were good. Vayikhu lahem nashim, mikol asher bacharu, and they took for themselves wives from whatever they chose. Notice the combination of the same three terms. They see something good, vayiru, they see, and vayikhu, they took whatever they wanted. The presumption being they didn't consult, it wasn't consensual, nor did they ask permission, they took. So it's taking, once again, something that you perceive as good, but without the appropriate, without permission, violating either an explicit command or an implicit command. And shortly thereafter, the Torah says right away that God says, I will limit the years of the human being on earth to 120 years. And after that, right immediately after that, we're told that the world is filled with wickedness and that God decides to destroy the world. After the first sin of Adam and Eve, God condemns them to death. They don't die immediately, but there's a sentence of death. So the two stories are clearly linked. They're linked in terms of theme, and they're linked in terms of language. Now, why do I mention all this? Because the primal sin of seeing and taking, I want to understand this. Something I noticed last year, I never saw this before. Not fully. Now it comes to Abraham goes down to Egypt. Before he gets there, he says to his wife, we're going to a bad place. Of course, the obvious question would be, his wife doesn't ask the question, so why go? But okay, but famine, you know, famine. It's a business decision, dear. That's what he says, though. You know, but the famine, we can't. So, the point is that when the Egyptians see you, they may kill me. Now, what happens over here? What does the Torah say? Look, it's very interesting. Maybe you read it 1,000 times. Maybe you never noticed this till now. I didn't. I read it many times. Here's what it says. And Abraham says to his wife, say you're my sister, right? Why? In verse 13. In order that it go well for me, l'man yitavli bavurech, that it be good for me because of you, and that I live. Next verse. When they came down to Egypt, verse 14, the Egyptians saw the woman. She was very pretty. Next verse. The Egyptians saw her, and the officers of Pharaoh saw her, and praised her unto Pharaoh. Vatukacha isha beit paro, she was taken into Pharaoh's house. Next verse. But concerning Avram, heitiv bavurah, it was good for him. He was given all kinds of things, including female slaves. Notice the four verses, they're very striking. The intermediate two verses describe the Egyptians as seeing and taking. Vayiru, fatukach. Precisely the two verbs that we have both in Genesis 3 and 6. But in Genesis 3 and 6, what they see is good. Both, in both cases, tov, or tovotena. But the one who does the taking also gets the good. In Genesis 12, it's a variation on the theme. The Egyptians see and take, but to whom does the good accrue? In verse 13 and verse Abraham. L'man yitavli, tov, that it be good for me. And what is the truth? The truth is, Avram hitiv bavurah, and it was good for Abraham. So what does that mean? It means that Abraham, essentially, is an accomplice to the primal sin. It means he is benefiting from what the Egyptians do. And the point is, even without the language, the language makes it very striking. Now here's the point I want to make. If you think about chapter 6, the second instance of seeing and taking and good, right after that, immediately after that, the world is filled with wickedness, and God decides to destroy the world. That's the beginning. You flip the page, and now the Torah says, these are the generations of Noah, story of Noah. And God said to Noah, I plan to destroy the entire world. Why? Ki malah ha'aretz chamas v'pneihem, because the world is filled with chamas. Chamas means wickedness, violence or violent wickedness. That's the story. Now we turn to our chapter in chapter 16. We begin our little study of Sarah and Abraham and Hagar and Ishmael. And here's the point I want to make. Hagar looks down upon Sarah. She becomes pregnant immediately. Sarah's living in the land for 10 years and can't conceive. Sarah goes to Abraham and says, Chamosi olecha, the Hamas is your fault. The point that Hamas is a powerful term. The violent wickedness is upon you. And what generates, I think, such a powerful response is precisely the link that the Torah makes between the story of Egypt, the story of Sarah in Egypt, where she is taken and provably violated by Pharaoh. We don't know how long she's there. Abraham, essentially, what Hagar represents for her in this context is Abraham benefiting from her humiliation and her suffering. Chamasi alecha. The point here is that there's a direct connection between the story of Egypt that begins the Abraham narrative and Sarah's mistreatment and the story of Hagar in chapter 16. And in my opinion, the Torah makes the connection in a different way too. Also very subtle. If you turn back for a moment to chapter 12. So Abraham goes down to Egypt. And what is his purpose in going down? What does he say? His purpose is, he says to his wife, listen, do me a favor, say you're my sister. This way it's going to be good for me, he says. Rashi, who is not an anti-Semite, I would say, has three words. It will be good for me, says Rashi, v'yitnuli matanot, they'll give me gifts. Rashi, of course, picks up on the fact that's what happens. Maybe if they think I'm your brother, they'll want to negotiate for you, and I'll be able to make a good deal for us, and then, you know, we'll leave with the money. That's what he's somewhere along those lines. That's what happens in the story. So, Abraham leaves with great wealth. He's actually kicked out of the land. When he leaves Egypt, in chapter 12, he leaves with all kinds of things. In fact, if you look at the text, he leaves, in verse 16, he's given flocks of animals, slaves, male and female, he-asses, she-asses, and camels. But now we're told, if you turn to chapter 13, page 48, it's very interesting. Abraham went up from Egypt, he and his wife, all that he had, with Lot. In verse 2 of chapter 13, on page 48, V'Avram kaved mi'od, Abraham was very heavy. They translate very rich, but kaved means heavy. In cattle, in silver, and in gold. It's interesting that the Torah here mentions silver and gold. It didn't mention silver or gold in chapter 12, did it? Why does it mention silver and gold? I know it's a petty, I have very small, but that's just the way I am. Small things, right? Pachim katanim, the little things, but they're important. The little things lead us to great things. Why did the Torah mention here the silver and the gold? It mentioned earlier the animals and the slaves. But in chapter 13, verse 2, Abram was very heavy in cattle, in gold, and silver. And you see, it's interesting. See, the story, who is Abraham? Abraham is basically a kind of Bedouin. He travels from one place to the next. That's the whole, his whole story is like this, of seeking out God's place. That's his story. When you're traveling, one thing you don't want to be is kaved, heavy. It weighs you down. So the point over here is, when the Torah wants to say, Avram kaved mo'od, he was heavy. Remember, he went down to Egypt, says the Torah, ki kaved hara'av ba'aretz, for the famine was heavy in the land. The Torah picks up on that motif. See, the cattle and the slaves don't weigh you down, because they move by themselves. The gold and the silver can weigh you down. And in fact, he is weighed down sort of, in a sense, symbolically weighed down. Because what's the next thing that happens in the story? The very next thing that happens after he comes out with all the wealth. The next verse tells us that Lot, his nephew, also has possessions. and the shepherds are fighting. And the immediate fallout of the wealth in chapter 13 is the separation of Abraham from Lot, who at that point in time is his only potential heir. So there's an immediate negative fallout in terms of the, by describing Abraham as conveyed, which is a negative term for one who's traveling all the time. And the immediate result of the wealth that he garners by trading in his wife, as it were, or allowing her to be taken, is separation from his nephew Lot. Now in the Torah, the word kaved means heavy, and there's another word that means quite the opposite, and they often come together, and that word is kal. Now the point is, of course, the Torah, which began the story of Egypt in chapters 12 and 13, but now we go to chapter 16, we go back to Egypt. It's always returning to Egypt. And what happens in chapter 16? After Sarah gives Hagar, the slave, to Abraham, his wife. Vatera ki harata, vatekal givirta b'yeneha, that Sarah became light in her eyes. Sarah said to Avram, the injustice is your fault. I gave you my slave, and when she became pregnant, for a kal b'yeneha, I became light in her eyes. May God judge between us. In other words, if I'm light in her eyes, the dog looks like its master. It's because I'm light in your eyes. Where do we see a story in which, in other words, what does going down to Egypt mean for Abraham? What does he say to his wife? He says, listen, I'm making a business decision. Help me go along with it. On one hand, you're not worth very much because you are a barren woman. God made a big promise to me. You don't bring anything to the table. I mean, I don't dislike you, or you're my, you know, like my sister. You don't share my destiny. With you, I have no destiny. So please do me a favor. There's a good business proposition in Egypt. It's going to be good for me. So there's a double problem in that story. There's the overvaluation of the wealth, which ends up causing only conflict and separation, because Avram is conveyed. Because, of course, the Torah returns to it in chapter 16 by focusing on the other side of the equation. The money was overvalued. The human being was undervalued. She was kal. That's precisely the story of chapter 16. I like this so much, I got to tell you. I think this is amazing, actually. It's so simple, you know? Whoever sees this. But the point is, here's the point. We can't, the point is that the story of Egypt is really the seminal story of Abraham and Sarah. You can't avoid it. Everything goes back to Mitzrayim. And in case you missed the point, Hagar is an Egyptian. And in fact, at the end of the Ishmael narrative, where does he go? He marries, his mother marries him off to a woman from the land of Egypt. At the end of the story, she goes back to Egypt, as it were, close, geographically close to Egypt, but symbolically back in Egypt, and then she brings her son Yishmael back to Egypt. This is the context of the story of Abraham and Sarah and the story of Yishmael and Hagar, and it's very important to understand this. I'll come back to this later on, but I wanted to move ahead now to chapter 21, the reading of Rosh Hashanah. And to focus in on the second part of this, the first part deals with the birth of Isaac. It begins with the words that God remembered Sarah. I'll come back to this at the end. Hashem pakad et Sarah kasher amar. Now we move to page 72. After Isaac is born, and Abraham makes a big party on the day that Isaac is weaned. And now we have a few verses. It says, Vatera Sarah, on the top of page 72. Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, who had given birth for Abraham, mitzachek. Here they translate making sport, or laughing, or perhaps mocking. It's a negative word, mitzachek. It's also, of course, a play on the name of her son, which is Yitzchak, or Isaac. She sees, Sarah sees this. Abraham doesn't seem to see this. Notice that the text doesn't mention Yishmael by name. Because what she's seeing is not so much, she sees in Yishmael Mitzachek, she doesn't just see Yishmael Mitzachek, she sees the son of Hagar. She remembers the taunting of Hagar, and she says to herself, the son is like his mother. That's what she sees. Vatomer li Avraham, she goes to Abraham and says, Garesh ha'amah azot v'yetbena, chase out this woman together with her son. For the son of the slave woman, she says, shall not inherit with my son, with Isaac. So Sarah here demands of her husband Abraham that he banish the woman together with her son. Verse 11, which is a very important verse in the story, tells us, "Vayirah davar miol b'enei Avraham al odot b'no," that the matter was evil very evil in Abraham's eyes on account of his son. Now, from this we can conclude two things. One is simply the point that he doesn't really care one way or the other about her. It wasn't evil on account of her. Basically, it's what Abraham said back in chapter 16, not his finest moment, when she complained to Abraham, the violent injustice is your fault. You treat me like a shmata. I know you always did. That's what she says. And this is just a continuation of Egypt. What is Abraham's answer in chapter 16? He says, listen, the slave, she's in your hands. Do whatever you want. In other words, didn't take responsibility for it. Do whatever you want. Say, I care about her. Do whatever you want. Sarah tortures her and she runs away. In this case, she makes a direct demand of Abraham, you chase her out. And you chase her out together with her son. Says the Torah, but the matter was very evil in Abraham's eyes on account of his son. And there's a very important point over here, critical to the Abraham story. The Torah could have said, I'm going to postulate a new principle of reading the Bible. And here's what it is. The Torah could have said, the matter was very evil on account of Ishmael. This is what the Torah means, obviously. He's concerned about Ishmael. Instead, it uses a different word, on account of his son. Now, his son actually is an ambiguous word in the sense that he has two sons. But clearly, the favorite interpretation is that the son refers to Ishmael. That's the one he's upset about. So I postulate the following formula. When the Torah uses an ambiguous term, which the context disambiguates, right? Because it means one thing. His son is Ishmael. If you stop, Abraham's walking in the street. Abraham, how are you? Your son. You have a son, don't you? What's his name? Ishmael. That's his son. His son is Ishmael. We have to remember that when God said to Abraham back in chapter 17, Sarah's going to have a child. After Abraham falls down laughing, he says to himself, shall such an old woman give birth? And Abraham turns to God and says, would Ishmael live before you? The first thing on his... But what about Ishmael? That's his immediate concern is about Ishmael, which is his firstborn and his son. Now, when the Torah says the matter was very evil in Abraham's eyes on account of his son, it means only one thing, which is that he's not going to do it. He's not going to do a very evil thing, and we have now reached an impasse in the family. She demands that the mother and son be expelled, and Abraham will not do it, because the matter is very evil. At this point, what is called for is a third party. In this case, God steps in, and God says to Abraham, in verse 12, let the matter not be evil in your eyes about the boy and about the slave woman. Everything Sarah says to you, obey her. For through Isaac shall your seed be called. For Gamet ben Haaman, the son of the slave woman, I'll make him a nation, for he is your seed. That's what God says. Notice two things about what God says. First of all, the language that God uses, the nar and amatecha, the slave woman and the boy, the son of the slave in verse 13, precisely echoes what Sarah says, how Sarah refers to Ishmael. For Abraham, it's his son. For Sarah, it's the son of the slave woman. But there's something else about verse 12 that's very interesting to us, and that is, God said to Abraham, everything Sarah says, obey her. Kol asher tamarei lecha. Everything she says, obey. Which, of course, is a direct reference to chapter 16. Because when she first goes to Abraham and says, listen, we're married 10 years, I can't have a baby. Let me give you my slave as your amma. Vayishma Avram will call Sarai. He obeyed her. Now what God says is, you listened to her then when she said, take the woman. And now I command you to listen to her once again in everything that she says, because through Isaac will your name, the covenant, as God said earlier in chapter 17, is to be continued through Isaac. Don't worry about him. He's going to be fine. He'll get a blessing too. He'll be a great nation. But ki b'Yitzchak yikarei l'chazara. But through Isaac shall your covenant be extended. So this is what God says to Abraham in verse 12. So we take note of the following fact. Abraham himself, because a lot has been spoken about this and all, Abraham doesn't want to send him away. Abraham's expelling of Ishmael is directly a function of God's direct command. Otherwise, Abraham's not going to do it. The idea that somehow he has something against Ishmael. But let me just briefly comment about the story and about the need to send Yishmael away. The story is actually a terrible tragedy in a certain sense, because it's very sad that it came to this point. I mean, they had an initial plan. The initial plan was that the spiritual parents of this child, who could be the covenantal child, the spiritual parents would be Abraham and Sarah. That was Sarah's plan. It doesn't happen, first of all, because Sarah drops out of the picture in chapter 16 because of her own misconduct. She tortures Hagar, who runs away. And Hagar in the desert is told by an angel, if you go back, the child will be yours. You will name him. And the child is, in fact, named by Hagar and by the child's father, Abraham, Ishmael. God has heard. Abraham sees it as a response to his prayer to God to present me with a son. And Sarah drops out of the picture. In chapter 21, Abraham drops out of the picture, and the sole parent actually becomes, or the primary parent becomes Hagar. But the fact of the matter is that sometimes in life, I mean, you have to do what you have to do at the time that you do it. It's true that it's very sad it came to this. And the main culprit in the story, of course, is Abraham himself. Because it begins with this mistreatment of Sarah back in Egypt. That's where we found Hagar in the first place. There's no doubt that Abraham is the main villain. But the fact of the matter is, whosever fault it is, we've come to a point where Yishmael has to be sent away. Let me just explain clearly why he has to be sent away. He has to be sent away because Abraham's mission in life is to create someone, or is to create a family in which he can have succession. The man's name is Avram, great father. And remember that in the Bible, we first encounter Abraham when he's 75 years old. Unlike, say, Moses or Jacob, where we're told about their birth and their youth, we encounter great father when he's 75. Which means that, and the 75-year-old man who has no children. So the issue from day one is that of succession. Who shall succeed him? He has a covenantal blessing, but who shall succeed him? Maybe it's his nephew Lot. That doesn't work. Eliezer of Damascus, he's a non-starter. Yishmael, Abraham thinks yes. At the end of the day, it's Isaac. But we have a situation, in other words, Abraham clearly favors Beno, who's Ishmael. But we have to remember that there's another two stories that are related to Abraham seeing Ishmael the way he does. And those two stories have to do with Sarah and how he sees Sarah. The way he sees Sarah, both in chapter 12 and especially in chapter 20, story of where again she's taken, story that precedes the reading of Rosh Hashanah, Abraham travels in chapter 20 to the land of the Philistines. In the beginning of chapter 20, he says about Sarah, she is my sister. Which is a rather remarkable statement, given the fact that in chapter 17, God said to Abraham, Sarah, your wife, will bear you a covenantal child. The Briti Akim et Yitzchak. Nonetheless, he actually invites the world to take her. She's not married to me, she's my sister. In chapter 20, which is the second of the sister stories, after King Avimelech grabs Sarah, so she's taken by Pharaoh in 12 and by Avimelech in chapter 20, and after Avimelech takes Sarah, in chapter 20, God appears to Avimelech. Return this woman, she's married to someone else. Avimelech says, "What? I'm a righteous man, what is this? Would you kill a righteous person too? I mean, he said, she's my sister, and she said, he's my brother. My hands are clean, my heart is pure. God says to him, I know you're pure, that's why I'm talking to you. So I'm telling you to give her back. And if not, I will kill you and all that you possess." So, Avimelech is another story. He fooled a lot of people, including some of the commentaries. He's a phony from top to bottom. It doesn't matter. The point is, Avimelech goes to Abraham, chapter 20. And he says to Abraham, why did you lie to me? You almost got me killed. What is this? Says Abraham, three different answers, which makes us very suspicious right away. Answer number one is, I was afraid for my life. I thought it was a good answer. Of course, it's not a completely good answer, because why do you go there? He doesn't have to go to the Philistines. He had to go to Egypt, he thinks, the famine. There's a reason. There's no reason. Oh, fine, whatever. I was afraid. Then answer number two. By the way, he said, she really is my sister, he says. She's my half-sister. From my father's side, but not my brother's side. And then he has the third answer. The third answer is, we do this wherever we go. That's another answer. That's the third answer. Wherever we go. That you hear all the time. Why do you do this? We've done this for 20 years. What are you talking about? Right? This is three answers, none of which are any good. But I want to question the second answer. What does this mean? He says, Abraham, listen, last night God appeared to me and threatened to kill me and all I possess because I took your wife. He said, she's your sister. To which he says, she really is my sister. She's my half-sister. I mean, she's your fourth cousin also, but who cares? I mean, but she's also your wife. What is Abraham, what is this? How do we understand this? But when Abraham, I have only one way to understand it. He says, listen, let me tell you the truth. I didn't lie to you. It's true she's my wife. That is true. But that's not how I see her. I don't see her as my wife. She's fundamentally my sister. Now, what is the difference between a wife and a sister? The wife in Genesis shares your destiny. The sister does not. We have to remember, when Abraham in chapter 15 turns to God and says, I have no children, he doesn't say, we have no children. He says, I have no children. It's not like Isaac who prays for Rebekah. There is nobody else but Abraham. It's completely narcissistic in his part. It's no mention of Sarah ever. You gave me no child. And my Eliezer and the one who runs my house will inherit me. It's all about me. There is no us. And basically, sometimes, you know, we tell a lie. And what happens is we end up believing our own lie. It starts off with a lie. It starts off, I know you're beautiful, but say you're my sister. That's in chapter 12. And there's a reason for it, for good or worse. You know, I'm not justifying it. It's a terrible mistake, obviously. But the point is, but at least there's a reason. It's not without... But in chapter 20, after he's been told already that Sarah will bear him a child, she's my sister. And Avimelech turns to Sarah afterwards and says, I've given your brother 1,000 coins, he says. He calls him a brother. It's God is screaming wife. And Abraham says, no, she's really my sister. I took her as a wife, but she's my sister. So the point is, we've arrived at a situation in the family where the true wife is a sister, where the wife he cares about is a slave, where the son of the slave is the one who's going to inherit him, and the son of the true wife is nothing. It's just that. So the problem is really about Abraham. It's Abraham's problem. Abraham can't see. Abraham, the only way to set this right is to banish Ishmael. Now, it's very sad that it comes to that. It's actually tragic that it comes to that. But the fact of the matter is, whatever the prior causes are, whatever fault it may be, but you have to deal with the situation as it is at the present time. The mitzvah of the moment, Abraham does it kicking and screaming, but he does it. It's not his intention to do it. He refuses to do it. It's wicked concerning his son, not about her. God, you have to obey everything she says, because you'll never see Isaac as long as Ishmael is there. And that's the story over here. And Abraham, who is a obedient servant of God, in the very next verse gets up early in the morning and gives Hagar lechem and mayim, places it on her shoulder, somehow shechma. The shechem, the shoulder, is found several places in the Bible, including the story of Shechem, city of Shechem. It always refers to the same. We have in English, to shoulder responsibility. He puts it on her. She becomes responsible for her child. And that's the story that we read on Rosh Hashanah, Hagar's behavior in the desert. Hagar, who now is solely responsible for her son, and how she behaves. Let me just briefly describe what the Torah says about Hagar's behavior. A couple of comments, then go back to the beginning and wrap it up. And if you have comments or questions, I'm happy to respond. There have been a lot of things said about these chapters, about Abraham, the binding of Isaac, and I must say respectfully that I disagree with 99% of them, because the story is problematic, but I think the text is clear about how one responds to the text. Everybody's welcome to respond differently. But what does the text actually say? There's been a lot of blame of Abraham in the story, and I blame him too, but for other reasons. Not for sending him away at this point, but of behaving in such a way that it leaves him no alternative. But the point, the idea that he sent them off to the desert with minimal food, and that he's responsible for this boy who's going to die of thirst in the desert, I think is completely untrue. The point of the Torah is not that he gave him too little provision. It's like a bread and water. Bread means that which sustains you. He put it upon Hagar, and the Torah says, Vatelech Vateta, but she went and got lost in the desert of Beersheba. Hagar gets lost. And let me just say straight out that getting lost in this book is not about having a bad sense of direction. The people that get lost in Genesis are morally lost. There are two other people in this book of whom the Torah speaks of getting lost. One is Joseph, who can't find his brothers, in chapter 37, Toeba Sadeh. And the other is Abraham himself in the previous chapter, when he says to Avimelech, we do this every place we go. Ever since God caused me to wander from my homeland. And that statement, which is almost a confessional, is of course very true. If you can speak about, we do this every place, she really is my sister, and give three different excuses for bad behavior, it means that you truly are lost. You don't understand where you're going, the mission. So the point of the story is not that it's Abraham's fault. The point is that it's Hagar's fault. She shouldn't get lost, but she doesn't know where she's going. I would say, by the way, that this not knowing where she's going is found not only in chapter 21, but even in chapter 16. Remember in chapter 16, when after she runs away from her mistress Sarah, an angel confronts her in the desert. And the angel has a question. The angel says, Hagar, slave of Sarah, from where do you run and where do you go? Remember what Hagar answered? I run away from Sarah, my mistress. But she never answered the second part of the question, because there is no answer. Now, sometimes in life you have to leave, and even though you don't know where you're going, that's true. It's very true. Sometimes you just have to get out. But the fact of the matter is, it's still interesting that both in chapter 16 and chapter 21 is about a person who doesn't have a clear sense of direction of where she's headed. And she gets lost. And getting lost is dangerous in the desert, and she runs out of water. And then the Torah describes her behavior. It says she took her son and put him under the shrubs. And in verse 16, and she went and sat down across from him as far as a bow shot. For she said, I will not see the death of the boy. And she sat across and raised up her voice and cried. In verse 17, the Torah says, Vayishma Elohim kol anar, God heard the cry of the lad. And the angel of God called out to Hagar from heaven and said, Hagar, what's wrong? Don't be afraid. God has heard the cry of the boy, the one over there. Go lift up the lad and hold his hand. I'll make him a great nation. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled up the jar with water and fed the boy. Now, what is this description over here of Hagar? It's very striking, actually. The elements of the story. And I would say there are several elements of the story that are striking in their own, in its own place, and especially striking in the larger context of the Abraham narrative. We have to remember that chapter 21 has been preceded by chapter 16. In chapter 16, she was promised a blessing concerning Ishmael. I will make him a great nation. Go back home, you'll have a child. God has heard your suffering. So she has a covenantal promise. Not covenantal, she has a promise of protection, of growth. And yet she despairs in the desert. So it means she doesn't really have faith in the promise. And in despairing of the promise, and despairing of the situation, she does something else. She places her child under the shrubs, and she stands a distance from the child and cries. It's very striking in the context of the very next chapter of the Torah, where Abraham walks with his son Isaac with the intention of sacrificing him. There the Torah repeats twice, Vayechush Nehem Yachdav, the two walk together. But in the story over here, you know, Bergman movie, Cries and Whispers, you ever see Cries and Whispers? It's all about being there, that's the point. And someone is being with somebody when they're suffering, when they're dying. And what Hagar can't do, Hagar stands away. And in fact, how far away does she sit? A bow shot away. What does her son become in the desert? Rove Kashat, an archer. The Torah directly makes a connection. He becomes a killer, an archer. He was abandoned in his youth by his sole parent, by his mother. And in fact, God actually critiques her. God says, Hagar, it's a question, why are you afraid? All of God's rhetorical questions, without exception, are hostile. They're all criticism. God says, beginning with the first one, Adam, where are you? It's not a question. It's a critique. God hears the cry of the boy, the one over there, Basher Husham, the one you abandoned, the one over there. Hold on to him. And finally, in verse 19, the third aspect, element of the critique, and God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. If you remember the binding of Isaac, which describes Abraham seeing, the other Torah uses a different term. Abraham lifted up his eyes and he saw. The binding of Isaac's story, which is essentially not so much about faith, I think, much more about perception. Abraham's ability to see what God wants. He sees from a distance. He sees behind him. He sees the ram behind him. How can you see behind you? Because you know it has to be there. It's about Abraham's ultimate perception of God's demand. But in chapter 21, the Torah describes Hagar differently. God opened her eyes and she saw a well of water. The well of water was always there, but she wasn't seeing it. So it's about Hagar's aimlessness, her lack of direction. It's about Hagar's despairing of the promise, not believing in the prior promise. And finally, it's about her failure to see. That's what the story is really about. It's not a blaming Abraham for anything. It's blaming Hagar. At the end of the day, she really goes back to Mitzrayim. She goes back to Egypt, where she began the story. And she marries her son off to a woman from the land of Egypt. Now I suppose the question would be, this is what we're reading on Rosh Hashanah. One can ask the question, I think, to which I have a less good answer, why is this the reading for Rosh Hashanah? I mean, what is the connection between this and Rosh Hashanah? I have actually several suggestions that I've already said a few minutes earlier. When somebody gives three answers, it's usually a bad sign. Usually there's one good answer. But I think it is true to say that in general, when one asks questions like, why was this Haftorah chosen? And what are the connections between the Haftorah and the Torah reading? There usually is one very good answer. I think usually there's several other answers as well. There are more than one connection. Let me make two points about the reading of Rosh Hashanah, which I think suggests at least a connection to the idea of Rosh Hashanah. The first point I would make about this reading of Rosh Hashanah is that, first of all, let me begin by saying the first question would be, what is Rosh Hashanah about, actually? At least the Rosh Hashanah that emerges from our liturgy. Well, Rosh Hashanah is about, in terms of the liturgy, clearly, given the nature of the blessings of Rosh Hashanah, the prayers of Rosh Hashanah, it's about kingship. It's about God's kingship. It's about God's governance of the world. Rosh Hashanah is about seeing the world differently than we usually see it, which is usually about ourselves and our place and our privileges, sometimes our responsibilities. But we see the world as our world. And in Rosh Hashanah, we are seeing the world very differently, which is we're seeing ourselves in God's world. The reading of Rosh Hashanah, the reading of the first day of Rosh Hashanah, the primary reading of Rosh Hashanah, I think suggests to us that God is involved, and actually God is directing human affairs. And I think in two different ways. In the text that we just read together, we have the story in which Sarah demands that Abraham chase out Hagar together with the son of the slave, as she calls him. And Abraham clearly will not do it. The thing was very wicked in Abraham's eyes on account of his son. He's not going to throw out his son. At which point in the story, God intervenes. And God said to Abraham, listen to everything she tells you. And Abraham, being God's obedient servant, does what God demands. So what the story tells us on one level is, God has a plan. God wants Isaac to be the covenantal son. God wants their child to be the covenantal child. And God therefore demands that Abraham obey Sarah. God is forced to intervene in human affairs, even though God has explicitly said earlier in the Torah, I prefer not to get involved. That's the story of Noah. Noah, you run the world. Everything's going to keep functioning. And you're in charge. But sometimes God has no choice but to intervene, like the story of Sodom, like the story of Egypt, because people can't save themselves, because the slaves can't redeem themselves. God has to get involved. And the story of Abraham and Sarah, like the story of Egypt, is a story in which God gets involved. In fact, I was thinking this morning a new thought about this. You know, there's always something new. I haven't had that much time to think fully about this, so what I'm saying now may be wrong, but I was wondering about the very first verse of the Torah reading of Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of chapter 21, V'Adonai pakad et Sarah kasher amar. V'yas Adonai l'Sarah kasher diber, that God remembered, pakad, remembered Sarah as God had spoken. God did to Sarah what God had spoken. Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham, who was old, at the time of which God had spoken. And Abraham called his son that was born to him from Sarah, Isaac. And Abraham circumcised Isaac his son at the age of 8 days, as God had commanded him. And every one of those verses takes us back to chapter 17. Every one of them. Abraham the old man, the commandment of circumcision, the 8 days, the promise, the Moed that the Torah mentions both in chapter 17 and 18. It's interesting that here we have the word for remember, Pakad. To the best of my recollection, in the book of Genesis, the word Pakad appears one other place, in a very important place. It appears at the very end of Genesis, as Joseph is dying, and his brothers come to Joseph, and the brothers are afraid Joseph will kill them. And the brothers say to Joseph, "We'll be your slaves." And Joseph cries. Joseph says, "No, I'm not God," he says. But I swear you, he says. "I forswear you. I make you swear," whatever the right word is, "that when I die, you will take my bones back with you into the land. For God someday will redeem us. God will certainly save you, redeem you, and you will bring my bones up with you." The word pakad appears at the very end of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus. The people remember when Moses goes down that God had remembered his people. Now I was thinking about this and wondering about the connection between God remembering Sarah and God remembering the Jews in the land of Egypt, as Joseph had prophesied at the end of Genesis. And what struck me was that there's another parallel between Egypt and between the story of Sarah. And that is that in chapter 21, as we read on Rosh Hashanah, it's all about God remembering Sarah as God had spoken. And God did to Sarah as God had spoken. And Sarah gave birth to a child at the appointed time. And I was remembering the Torah's description of the Exodus from Egypt at the end of chapter 12. Lo shimurim hu Hashem lo tziyam yaretz Mitzrayim. It was the night of watching to take them out of Egypt. A night of watching for all generations. Be'etzem ayom azeh, on this self same day, be'etzem ayom azeh, the Torah repeats, God took Israel's hosts out of Egypt. The idea that this is the moment in time that has been appointed, the waited for moment, the lel shimurim, the be'etzem ayom azeh, the appointed time, is very eerily similar to what you have over here with Sarah. And I think it takes us back to the way we began this evening. Sarah was in Egypt. Sarah in Egypt foreshadows Israel in Egypt. Sarah was the one who suffered. Abraham doesn't suffer in Egypt. Abraham gets the she-asses and the female slaves and the male slaves and the gold and the silver. The one who suffers, the one who's oppressed, the one who's enslaved, the one who's mu'una, which has always a sexual meaning, who's tortured, is captured, is the outsider, is Sarah. And therefore Sarah represents Jewish destiny. Sarah is the one who suffers. And in fact, the two suffering Jews of the book of Genesis are Sarah on one hand, and her grandson, who I believe is named for her, Israel, or Jacob. And those are the two that the Torah says Israel, all of Israel, mourned for them and cried for them. And the two that represent Jewish destiny. So, Vashem pakad et Sarah kasher amar, I think what we're saying is, it's not just about God remembering in a positive way, which is part of it. The day of Rosh Hashanah, after all, is called Yom HaZikaron in the liturgy. But it's actually more than just remembering about what happened. Because I think the point of the story is that God remembers Sarah in a different way. The fact of the matter is, immediately preceding that verse is Abraham's statement to Avimelech, "She really is my sister." Immediately preceding the verse is the story where once again Sarah was captured. Sarah is taken. Abraham sees Sarah a certain way. She's my sister. I care for her, perhaps, but she doesn't share my destiny. But Vashem pokad et Sarah kasher amar, we begin the Torah reading by saying, God remembers Sarah differently. God sees in Sarah not Abraham's sister, not even Abraham's wife. God sees in Sarah the person who primarily represents the Jewish people's covenantal destiny. She's the one, after all, who does fulfill the terms of the covenant in her own way. She's the one who was captured, she's the one who was enslaved, she's the stranger. And the covenant is built upon the experience of Sarah. And at the end of the day, actually, Abraham comes to understand this, because after the binding of Isaac, which is about Abraham's affirmation of Isaac as his son, right after that he comes to recognize the truth about Sarah. And that's why in the chapter immediately following the binding of Isaac, he sets out to find a grave site for Sarah. He doesn't set out to bury Sarah. He's offered the burial for nothing. Everybody will give him a burial. He wants to purchase a burial site, which is the first acquisition in the land. And in the text of Genesis, it's Sarah's place. So I think the idea of God seeing differently. God has different eyes than Abraham. God has different eyes than anybody else. God is seeing Sarah differently at this point in time. Everything that's happened till now leads up to this point in time. So on Rosh Hashanah, we're asking God to see us differently. It's not just about God's intervention. God sometimes intervenes in human affairs. It's that God has different eyes. We ask God to see us favorably on Rosh Hashanah. That's how we end the blessing of Zichronot. Blessed you are God, Zocher HaBrit. See us covenantally. See us within a certain framework, a certain relationship. See us differently than we see ourselves. Don't see us as an impersonal outsider. See us with different eyes. See us with redemptive eyes. Vashem pakad et sarah kasher amar. That's one thought I had about this. I had another thought as well. And I'll conclude with this. And that is that the truth of the matter is that the reading of what we read on Rosh Hashanah, the central thing that we're reading on Rosh Hashanah, isn't so much about God remembering or redeeming Sarah. The primary reading is what we studied this evening, which is about Yishmael. That's the main. And I was wondering, and again, this is speculation, I was wondering if on Rosh Hashanah, which after all is the Day of Judgment, the Yom HaDin, the primary meaning of remembering in the liturgy, Tazocher Maaseh Olam, Upoked Kol Yetzurei Kedem, Lizkor Lifkod, in the service, refers to God's judgment. God's judgment of all humanity, God's judgment of individuals. And in that central section of Rosh Hashanah service, which begins with God remembering all creatures and judging them, and then it moves, and the person who represents this is Adam, actually. Adam represents. This is a remembrance of the first day, we say. Zikaron Liyom Rishon. Kichoku Yisrael Hu Mishpat Lohei Yaakov. That, what that alludes to is the Midrash, that the day of Rosh Hashanah is actually not the first day of creation, but rather the sixth day of creation. And the Midrash says the day that Adam was created, Adam sinned. And the day he was sinned, he was judged. And that every Rosh Hashanah, says the Midrash, that's the meaning of the text, of the liturgy. Most people don't understand this, but it's what it means. It's a remembrance of Israel accepts upon themselves every year that first day of that sixth day of creation. The day of creation was Rosh Hashanah, because it was the day of judgment. And Israel willingly enters into judgment every year. Kichoku Yisrael hu, mishpat Elohei Yaakov. That's the primary idea of remembering, which is judgment. Then you move to the secondary, which, because if it's just that, we're all doomed. So we move to the secondary, which the key point, Ashri Ish Elo Yishkacheka, happy is the one who does not forget God. It's about memory from the other side. There's some people who remember, and those people, says the V'atodoresh Ma'asei Kulam, I mean, God seeks them out. It's a play on the word Lidrosh, which in biblical Hebrew means both to study carefully, Rishav HaKira, but also to search for something. And the person who represents the one who can escape the judgment through his righteous behavior, who ascends the stage one day in the year. V'gamet Noach b'yavo zacharta. It's Noah. Noah represents God's providence, providential care. So begin with Adam, then you move to Noah. That still doesn't solve most of our problems, because Noah was righteous and perfect and all that. But what do we do for the average guy? I mean, not so righteous, not so perfect. So then we move to the third person, the third pillar of the Zichronot service, the third pillar of creation. There's Adam and there's Noah, and there's the final stage in creation, the securing of the sacred space, which in the book of Genesis is accomplished through by Abraham. Abraham secures the land. Abraham goes to Mount Moriah and secures the sacred temple space, the place that replaces Eden, and that's the culmination of the Zichronot. That's the idea of covenant. There we recall in our service the binding of Isaac, and we conclude with, blessed are you, O Lord, who remembers the covenant. What I was wondering about, and I guess I'll conclude with this thought, that on Rosh Hashanah we speak of ourselves as entering into judgment. And we don't see ourselves as necessarily righteous people, certainly not perfect. And even if we think of ourselves as perfect, our next door neighbor is certainly not perfect, right? So the point is, how do we see ourselves? How do we see the world on Rosh Hashanah? I'm wondering whether the Torah reading of Rosh Hashanah, which does of course deal with the birth of Isaac and talks about God's intervention and all that, But whether perhaps there's another point about the Rosh Hashanah service, and that is, in the reading of Rosh Hashanah, perhaps we see ourselves strangely as Yishmael. Yishmael, after all, he's not innocent. He taunted, he mocked. On the other hand, there is a sense of innocence to Yishmael. He's described variously in the Torah reading, both as a nar, teenager or whatever, but also as a yelid. It's called both a yelid and a nar. It's very interesting. Abandoned by his parents, and he's set aside from a distance, and his mother assumes he's going to die of hunger, and she doesn't take responsibility. She's too much despair, too much pain. And the Torah says, "Vayishma Elohim al kol hanar," that God heard the cry of the boy. And I was thinking about the service of Rosh Hashanah, that central service of Rosh Hashanah, the Zichronot, which, as I mentioned, is based upon Adam and Noah and Abraham. And of course, we all know that the Rosh Hashanah service, perhaps I should have distributed Machzorim for this, but let me just conclude by saying, the Rosh Hashanah service is the most unique service that we have. It consists, actually, it's very interesting, apart from the three themes of kingship and remembrance and shofar, each of those, the currency of the Rosh Hashanah service, are verses from the Bible. And they're very precise. The three verses from the Torah, three from the Psalms, as we have it, three from the prophets, and a tenth verse from the Torah. In the central section of the service, which is the remembrance section, Zichronot, when you come to the verses from the prophets, it's one of the highlights of the service. Ve'edei avadecha neviim katuv le'mar. Right? Ko amar Hashem. And we have three verses. Remember what the verses are. Zacharti lo chesed nu'urayach. The first is God remembers chesed nu'urayach, the loyalty of our youth, when you follow me into a desert, in a desolate land, that recalls we followed God into the desert. We didn't have it all worked out. We didn't have a plan. We didn't have a career path. You know, we went into the desert. That's the first verse. What's the second verse? V'zacharti ani et briti b'itach b'meinu urayach v'akimoti lach brit olam. Second verse also. I remember the covenant I made with you in your youth. So the first two verses, we talk about Israel in its youth. Sometimes you can't see such merit in the adult. Just remember them as a youth. And it's the third verse, most powerful of all. V'ne'emar, and it says, the verse from Jeremiah, Haben yakili Ephraim im yeled shashuim. Is Ephraim not my a little child? A yeled, a little child you play with? Kimidei dabri bo zachar esker. When I think of him, right? When I speak, I remember him. And I yearn for him. I will certainly have mercy, says God. So we end the Zichronot service. Interesting. We refer to ourselves in two ways at the end of Zichronot. First as a nar, as a youth, and ultimately as a child. It's very important in life to remember. You walk in the street, you see these people, homeless people. It's very important to remember they were once somebody's baby. It's powerful. We forget that, you know? And you get so hard and you walk. It was once a little child was born, the parents were so happy, you know? There's a little child in every person. That's when Rosh Hashanah, ultimately, we appeal to the youth and the baby in ourselves. And I was thinking, who is called the child and who is called the baby, if not Yishmael? And that's what we're appealing to. It's interesting. Now I conclude with this thought. Last year at the Drisha dinner, I always speak for 2 or 3 minutes at the dinner. Those are the hardest things, by the way. Speak for 3 minutes. Speak for 2 hours, I have no problem. 2 minutes, tough. And you know, what's interesting is, what does the Torah say? The Torah says that Hagar sat far away, bow shot away, and she lifted up her voice and cried. What's the next verse? And God heard the cry of the boy. And God said to Hagar, what's the problem? Don't be afraid. I have heard the cry of the boy, the one over there. The Torah never said the boy cried. Never said that. So she cried. But the truth is, actually, people are crying all the time. We have taught ourselves not to hear it. The world is filled with tears. We're not hearing it. And on Rosh Hashanah, there's also a terrible cry. It's the sound of the shofar. It's a cry. On Rosh Hashanah, we can't even express our deepest feelings on Rosh Hashanah. So we are sounding the shofar, which is both the instrument of God's coronation, but it's also a cry. resting God on Rosh Hashanah to hear our cries, the cries that we know we are sounding, and the cries that we are in our own hearts. Nobody hears them. Only God can hear the cries. And I think that's what the Torah is saying over here about this Nar and about the Yeled. Not just to see, we see ourselves as a child and as a baby, but it's beyond that. We're asking God to hear the inarticulate cry, which is, of course, what we read on Rosh Hashanah. God has heard the cry of the one who's not crying, because he is crying, but nobody hears it. I think I want to bless all of us. We should all hear the cries. It's very important. Thank you very much.
Amen.
Anybody has any comments or questions?
Yes. Yeah. I've always had a lot of trouble liking, in fact, I don't like her, Sarah.
Right.
She's a very, very...
I thought it was Abraham you didn't
say. Abraham's another story.
Right.
And I find it fascinating in line with your theme, which gives me an insight that Sarah is clearly a devious, difficult. I mean, but she's also harassed, pushed away by, you know, she's mistreated very badly by right. Abraham. And if we are identified on some level with Sarah, and God hears this very, very imperfect woman, then maybe we have a chance.
Right. Well, I think that's true of actually the characters in Genesis and actually the Bible in general are certainly not represented as being, you know, perfect. I mean, the great hero of Genesis, Jacob, is obviously very far from that, although I think he's transformed. The only thing I would take exception to, I don't see Sarah as devious, actually. I think Abraham is perhaps devious. Right. Jacob is certainly devious. Joseph may be devious in a certain way. I think that Sarah is someone who is mistreated by Abraham terribly. And sometimes people are mistreated to lash out at others. I think her mistreatment of Hagar, her torturing her, I'm not the first to say this, Nachmanides says it, it's a great sin, and you ultimately pay the price for these kinds of things. But the point I think about Sarah is that she does suffer. I think and the Torah places a premium on that. And I think the point is that, and she accepts, Abraham says, do this for me, she does it. I think that the main point is that at the end of the day, her conception that her son is going to be the one who enters into the covenant is actually correct. So there's a certain perception. I'm not sure that she's necessarily the paragon of virtue, but I think that Sarah and even more Rebecca are talking about people who have the right perception. I think part of having the right perception in Genesis and beyond has to do with, and I mentioned perhaps last year about Hannah. The people who see best in this world are people who are not vested in keeping things the way they are. And they tend to be people who are on the margins, who are powerless. It's true of, I think, the people who have the insight in Genesis. It's probably true of people who, it's true of artists. I mean, the real artist is one who sees things differently and sees them from a distance. And I think part of the idea of Genesis is that the women who are unempowered, certainly, who can't bless themselves, but they also have a sense of how the blessing is to proceed. I think that is the way my take on it. Though I can say like or dislike Sarah, I think that some of her treatment of Hagar in chapter 16 is obviously problematic. But I think ultimately she's more victim, and eventually she has the right insight. I think I would say that. Yes.
I was always sort of curious. Like, you know, we never see Sarah after the binding, right? Of Isaac.
Well, she dies right away, yeah.
And you know, it was always how she's feeling, but now I see her in a different light because I see that God perhaps saw her in a different way, and it sort of really transforms the way we look at her. Because maybe I've heard too much of Sam, that's why. But it really puts her in a much more perfect kind of world, and maybe says that we really have to not only bless our patriarchs but our matriarchs.
Right, it's about seeing things in a different way. I think that's very important. You know, it's funny. I don't want to get into politics yet, but I mean, I was just thinking about this the other day. Because Cheney was on TV, and he said, it doesn't matter if you like him or not, but he said something I think is very important, and I was thinking about this, and that is, talking about 9/11, he said that after 9/11, we saw it as a war, not as a law enforcement problem. And I was thinking about this, that I wish they'd say the same thing about oil, that it's not about economy, it's about national interest, you know, but it's all about how you see it, you know what I mean? And I think the point is, sometimes what a teacher does is gets you to see things differently. I think what God is, Hashem Pakad et Sarah, God is seeing Sarah differently. It's not the sister, he's seeing her as representing, through her experiences of suffering, as representing Jewish destiny. I think that's the point of it, and that's, I think, what we're asking for in Rosh Hashanah. God see us differently. We see ourselves differently. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Shakar. It's a great privilege and a wonderful beginning that we were able to be at this lecture tonight. I want to tell you that next Monday is our second lecture. Our rabbinic intern, Jeremy Oskowitz, will be speaking on self-perception and introspection in a rabbinic framework, and that will be Monday evening at the same time. Sunday we have a workshop in the morning, which is directed at our school and the parents in the school, but anybody can come, which is essentially the High Holy Days, all the questions you wanted to ask but never could. So we will have that opportunity as well. Yisher koach to you, again, Rabbi Silber. It's a great privilege to once again learn from you. Yisher koach. It's just so much wonderful material.
So happy. I know how much people, you know, some don't get more for the others.
Yeah, of course. It's great. It's wonderful.
It's
wonderful.
It's a real privilege.
Thank you.
Really.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stop everything, Jay. We're talking about abuse a lot.